My name is Courtney Bob, and I'm here at the Shabazz Center for Intellectual Inquiry on the campus of Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. And I am currently doing an interview with Miss Ricky Fairley, class of 78 at Dartmouth, who is in her home office in Annapolis, Maryland. Today is October 27th, 2022, and this is an interview for the Dartmouth Black Lives Oral History Project. Hi, Ms. Fairley. Thank you for being here today.
How are you, Courtney? It's so good to meet you.
Thank you. I'm well. It's even better to meet you. So first, I'd like to learn a little bit about your childhood. And can you please tell me the state and when you were born?
I was born on June 17th, 1956 in Washington, D.C. And we lived in D.C. for a few years. And then I really grew up in Silver Spring, Maryland.
Thank you. And can you tell me the names of your parents and a little bit about them?
Sure. My dad is Richard Fairley. Mm-hmm. He's class of 55, Dartmouth. And my mom is, her name is Wilma Fairley, Wilma Holmes. She's remarried since my dad died. They're both educators. My dad actually ends up getting a PhD in education. Actually, both of my parents went to Stanford to get their master's in education when I was in seventh grade. Mm-hmm. And then my dad went on to get a PhD, but he worked for the government in the Department of Education and was a civil rights leader. And my mom was a first grade teacher. Mm-hmm. And then for part of my childhood, and then she became actually the head of the first kind of D&I department in a school system in the country when I was in high school. And then she became a principal for 30 years.
Wow, that's amazing.
Elementary school principal.
Awesome. And what was it like growing up in Silver Spring, Maryland?
I had like a ideal childhood. I had a Cosby childhood. My parents, you know, both worked. I have one sister. She's 4 years younger. Mm-hmm. But I really had it. I can't, you know, I can only have good things to say about my childhood. I was a storybook childhood. I didn't realize kind of that we were middle class black family. I know we lived in the suburbs. We had moved out of the city and I had a lot of things. I had pretty much everything I wanted, but I didn't really realize that until I went to Dartmouth and I was around people who didn't have what I had. And my first boyfriend at Dartmouth was from the south side of Chicago, was a basketball player, had kind of made his way through, you know, growing up by playing basketball. And I remember, you know, going to his house at some point thinking, oh my gosh, like I have so much more. I didn't realize it until, and I, you know, probably I was one of my few friends at Dartmouth that actually had an allowance from mm-hmm. my parents. And I didn't realize what middle class was. So I went to Hanover, you know, I grew up around people that were like me, you know. I went to all white schools. Mm-hmm. I was pretty much always the only black in my class. My high school, I was the only black in my high school for most of the years. And I went to Catholic school, but I didn't really know anything different. My parents put me in a lot of black activities and we went to a black church and sort of to get that side of my cultural upbringing, but I didn't really know any different.
Thank you for sharing. That's very interesting to hear. So I know that your family has quite the legacy at Dartmouth. I know that your dad is an alum here as well as your two daughters. Yeah. And of course yourself. Can you tell me a little bit about why you decided to attend Dartmouth?
Well, you know, I actually had been talking about going to Brown. So my dad had a rule that he only, he said, if you want me to pay for college, you can go wherever you want. But if you want me to pay for it, you have seven choices. So I knew I had to go to an Ivy League school. Mm-hmm. And I had been at Dartmouth a lot over the years with my dad. We probably started going to Hanover to Winter Carnival when I was about 11 or 12. Mm-hmm. It was like our thing, me and my dad. But I applied everywhere and I pretty much got in everywhere. And I almost went to Brown and I'm not sure what persuaded me not to go to Brown, to go to Dartmouth, but probably my dad. And I think I had this familiarity with Dartmouth, but my junior year in high school, we came to Hanover and we stayed for 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And that's when they started BATA.
Okay, wow.
So I was the babysitter for all the alums' kids. And so my father basically locked me in the Hanover Inn and said, do not leave this hotel. There are boys out there and they're all over you. Don't even think about going out. So this was before coeducation. This was like my dad actually voted against coeducation. This is a
wow.
man of the world. a man's school. Too funny. When I said I wanted to go here, I was like, what? This is a man's school. This is for boys. But anyway, but I think that I started to talk to the boys and Hanover, you know, I don't know, maybe I was a junior, I was 16. So I think that like really got me attached to Dartmouth because I was there for 3 weeks on the campus, hanging out, you know, interacting with students. And so my connection and familiarity with Dartmouth was much greater than any other school I'd been to.
Wow, that is an amazing like insight. I'd love to hear more about it. So can we talk a little bit about your experience at Dartmouth? I know you said that you grew up middle class, you went to predominantly or all white schools, and you were often the only Black student there. And you got most of your, you said, cultural upbringing from being in church and being around family. So what was it like coming to a school that wasn't very diverse? Did you feel that that was very similar to your experiences? Did it change you in any ways? And also, what was it like being one of the first classes to experience Dartmouth in its entirety after coeducation? You can answer that however you feel.
Okay, so that was a lot of questions. So let me speak first to just sort of the cultural difference. So frankly, I had never been in a class with a boy. Mm-hmm. I went to all girls high school. I had never worn clothes to school. I'd worn uniforms my whole life. Mm-hmm. And so I had an 8 o'clock class. So I'd be like at 7:30 in the morning, like, oh my God, like I have to figure out what to wear. Like, cause there's going to be boys in the class. My English five class was at 8 o'clock in the morning. And, I would have to really think about it. And I was the only girl, the only Black and the only woman in the class. Mm-hmm. Right. So I was more worried about, oh my God, like I have to figure out what I'm like. Wearing uniforms, Bobby Socks and saddle shoes your whole life. All of a sudden you can wear jeans, you have choices, and like, oh my gosh, you get that thing about what you look like. Mm-hmm. Comb your hair. And like, I never had to deal with that before. So that was probably more transition than anything. But frankly, I was around more Black people in school at Dartmouth than I was in high school because I went to an all white, all girls school. Okay. So I had way more diversity in Hanover. I had never had a Black teacher. Uh-huh. Until Professor Cook and Professor Ray Hall, and until I had Black professors, until I came to Hanover. We had a Black dean family. We had Dean, you know, the Cottrell family. We had a lot of Black families on the campus. So we had a lot of Blacks in leadership that I had never seen in school before, you know, because I went to all white Catholic schools. Mm-hmm. So I think I probably had like reverse than most people because I came with diversity in Hanover. What a concept, right?
Yes.
Being the first, you know, third class of girls, like the senior class was still all male. Again, I had come from this environment where I was with all girls. So just to have any men around me was a thing, but to have, you know, I don't know what the ratio was. We go back and forth about, we think some people say 15 to one, 10 to one, 8 to 1, but there are a lot more men than women. Mm-hmm. And, so just getting used to just being around men in general was a thing for me just because I had been in an all-girls school. But I don't think it ever really fazed me. I think that, you know, maybe freshman year, the senior class was still all male. So they would kind of look at you like, who are you? And then Friday you were a girl, you know, but I learned pretty quickly that I didn't really think I could go into a frat house. It was Animal House. And frankly, I never set foot into a frat until Amanda went to Dartmouth.
Okay. And Amanda is your daughter, right?
Amanda, my daughter, that's a seven. And then I was like hanging out in the frats with her, you know, but I never went to frats, but I had such a great time. We had, an all Black cheerleading squad for the basketball team and we were totally hot.
You said you were really hot.
We were totally hot. We were totally hot. And, and I danced in Buddha, you know, I don't know. I had a very Black experience at Dartmouth with my Dartmouth, you know, friends. And, you know, my two roommates are still my besties.
And their names are?
Victoria Stewart. Mm-hmm. And she lives actually close to me in Virginia. And she's Jan Michelle Lemon Kearney. She actually is... She is an attorney in Cincinnati. She owns the Black newspaper there and actually is like the chief city council person there, but they're my besties, you know, they are, you know, my friends for life. We were the first group of people to live in Channing Cox. they kind of built Channing Cox. They didn't really say it, but for women, you know, and the first bathrooms we had were bathtubs. We had bathtubs, not showers. Girls wanted bathtubs. Isn't that crazy?
Wow.
So we had our apartment was 304, was called the girls in 304. They called our apartment the brick house. We had the best time. Our other room, and actually Angie, she actually passed at 45. She had a rare cancer. So our fourth person, but, we had such a great time. I mean, we had such a great time.
Wow, that is.
I mean, I have the best memories of Dartmouth and, you know, doing road trips with the basketball team and you know, we used to, like, on Thursdays, we used to all go, and we the AM was our home. The AM was our haven. We were in the AM all the time. And we'd all kind of gather on Thursday and say, okay, should we have a party this weekend?
Yeah. Well, you
know, it is midterms. But let's have a party anyway. Or you guys, you know, we shouldn't be having a party this weekend. We should be, you know. And then, but also in the AM, only men could live there. And the corner rooms were like the thing to do. So if you were like a baller, you lived in the corner room, right? But the AM was like where we went. And in the library, we basically had every paper, every exam. I mean, the plagiarism rules would not work in our favor because we all had all the tests, all the papers. So if you really needed help with studies, we helped each other out. And we'd be Thursday night studying together. Okay, who took the organic final? Who took the whatever midterm? Who took the whatever? And we had all the resources and helped each other out. Like I struggled with calculus. I struggled with Math 3 and I had like my little Math 3 team that got me through. But you never had to like worry about grades because you had a support system that was amazing. And all the upperclassmen helped us. You know, I had a big brother. His name was Rick Jones. He was a 76. And he's my brother to this day, you know. But, I mean, he took care of me, you know. Rick, I need help. Rick, and he would, like, he's like, okay, we got to get you a tutor. We got to get you whatever. Like, here's what you need. And so we had just an incredible connection with each other. And I don't see that. I didn't see that the same for even Amanda and Haley through their experiences. You know, they found resources, but our connection of sort of the Black students at Dartmouth were connected. But guess what? We only had one frat, Alpha, that had just started. So we didn't have them in all these divisions. And people will tell you, I'm the one that like talks badly about the Greek system at Dartmouth because I felt like it divided the community. We had one community. We were all one.
Okay.
And we had like the athletes and the whatever and the chili, but still, the AM was our home and we were all united.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Academically, spiritually, you know, we had the gospel choir, you know, and different people say they were the founder of the gospel choir, but it all happened in the 70s, right? We had Buddha that was really strong, but we also had a great network of grown-ups. We had Errol Hill. Do you know Errol Hill? He was a professor.
I do not.
He was a music professor. He ran the drama department. We had, oh my gosh, I can't even think of the music professor's name, but the Cottrell family, Dean Cottrell, we had a woman, Black woman dean, and her husband was the coach of the basketball team. We had another Black basketball coach. We had Dean Tranum, who was the, what do you call it? The chaplain of the college. So we had all these wonderful Black families on campus. I mean, I babysat for the Cottrells probably every other week. And I'd go to their house and they'd feed me fried chicken and mac and cheese and collard greens and I'd babysit for their kids. So we had a Black community that was like Camelot. It was like Camelot. I don't think my kids had that same level of leadership in place at the college to keep everybody together. But there was always somebody you could call. There was always a Black mom that you could call if you needed help or something, you know what I mean, on campus. You know, Errol Hill, Grace Hill is still there. You should go visit her. I don't know if she's on your list, but Errol Hill's wife. I just saw her at the Battery Union in May.
Uh-huh.
And she moved to like a senior citizen. But if you ask somebody where she lives, she'll go. And she's a force. But she was a force on campus. You know, their family was a force. I think they had three kids that went to Dartmouth.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely to Jaga and her brother, yeah. But yeah, She should be interviewed as part of this thing.
Okay. I'll write her name down right now.
She has incredible stories, you know, of her husband's work and her role on the campus.
Okay, so to continue, I know you mentioned a lot of your involvement with Buddha, the all-Black cheerleading team, Black Praxis, as well as the AM. Can you speak a little bit more about what it was like being in those organizations, kind of like at the prime time where they were really emerging? You had kind of peak unity in a way. Like, I know you said that your daughters, Haley and Amanda, didn't quite have the same... Haley and Amanda, correct?
Yeah, yeah.
That they didn't have the same kind of experience that you did in terms of unity. What was it like being in that moment?
Well, you know, we didn't know it was that moment.
Okay.
It was our life. It was our normal.
Mm-hmm.
I can look back on it now and compare it to my daughters and compare it to now, but we didn't know we were in a moment. We just knew we were in this space that was like Camelot, right? So we didn't know I know we were starting a lot of things for the first time or starting, like, you know, that's when Bada started and Buddha started, but we didn't really know we were making a moment. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
We were just doing our thing. And even we owned the radio station between midnight and two. Mm-hmm. And Walter Callender was the DJ. He's in my class. Have you heard of him, Walter Callender?
I have.
Yeah. But like we own the radio station between midnight and 2 a.m. So we all just stay up to listen to Walter Callender and our music.
That's awesome.
But we didn't know we were a thing. We did. It was, you know, we were just doing our thing. And clearly, you know, we were doing a lot of firsts because women were new. But, you know, we were just living our lives, living our best lives. So,
yeah, I love that. Mm-hmm. Okay. So thank you for sharing those experiences. So right now, what I would like to do is get a little bit more about the inside of what it was like outside of the Black community. Did you find yourself in spaces that were not necessarily Black life centered? And if so, how did you navigate them?
So I would say the place that I went out of the Black community was in my major.
Okay.
Then I had Professor Cook, who was like my mentor and my advisor. You know, do you know Bill Cook? Have you heard of Bill Cook?
I have not heard of Bill Cook, actually. And can you tell me what your major was?
English.
Okay.
And so Bill Cook was a force in the English department. He ran it, but he just died a few years ago. But he had this like one of those like curly mustaches and a bald head, and he was just this prophetic, amazing, poetic professor. And so I just like loved him, but I really became an English major because I love Sanborn House. And that was my study place because every day at 4 o'clock, they served tea and Pepperidge Farm cookies. And so I would go there every day at 4 o'clock after class and get my cookies and sit in the big cushy chair and study because that was my happy place. That became my happy place. And I really said, wow, this is really comfortable. And actually one day, Professor Cook walked in and he said, "What's your major?" I said, "Well, I think I'm pre-med, you know, because my father told me I should be pre-med, but I really don't like the sight of blood, but I'm taking all the classes." He's like, "Why don't you major in English?" And I'm like, "Why not? You know, I love to read, I love to write." And so even though I did pre-med, I came out thinking, I don't really want to be a doctor. That's what my father wanted me to be. So I was a major. And I can talk more about that. But in my English classes, I was often the only Black, but I had Professor Cook in so many of them or as a part of the conversations, right? And I don't know that I was in any other white spaces, to be honest with you, Courtney. I mean, you know, the basketball cheerleader team, we were on the basketball team where there were a lot of white people, but we were all Black. So I don't know that I operated outside of the Black community, because... And having come from this white school and being around all white people in school, I think I naturally gravitated to the Black people at Dartmouth. Make sense?
Yes.
That was my comfort zone. That was my comfort zone.
Wow. I'm interested in how much, I'm interested in the differences between like your upbringing and your very white kind of school experience and how that kind of was... Once you got to Dartmouth, I typically hear other, like the reverse of that. So I think that's
I know. I don't know. I was quite often the only person in class, the only woman in class. I think that made me outspoken. And I never really had a problem with being outspoken, but I think the one thing about going to an all-girls school is that you're told you're a badass from birth, and they make you a badass. Do you know what I mean? Like, they make you be outspoken, all the girl power thing. Absolutely. So I think Dartmouth strengthened that because I had to defend myself a lot, especially with white, maybe not so nice white men. Right. But it made me stronger. It didn't waver me. I saw it as a challenge, and I stood up to it. So it made me get stronger and be more outspoken and more of an advocate for myself. And it didn't intimidate me. Do you know what I mean? Like, and if it did, I would call my dad, and my dad was like, "What's wrong with you? You know better than that. You stand up for those white people." You know, he was an activist. So I think that it helped me become like the person that I am, that I don't take no for an answer. I don't say no, never the answer. It's always how. I learned that from my dad. But it made me, go head to head with a lot of people that wanted to argue with me. And I didn't let it rain on my parade. That's probably because of my dad and my parents, how they brought me up. But I was not intimidated in those environments. And I think maybe some of my black peers were because they hadn't gone to white schools. I think going and having gone to a white high school, I had to learn that already and stand up for myself,
Wow, that is very, very amazing to hear. So that actually brings me to what I want to talk about next. I'm trying to navigate how I want to ask you these questions.
Okay.
You just touched the nail right on the head about where I want to go. So you speak about your dad being an activist, how you learned not to take no for an answer, but rather to say like how, something along those lines.
Yeah.
One thing that we're learning about in class right now, or we read a book called Upending the Ivory Tower by Stephen M. Bradley. And basically it kind of takes us through the various social movements happening on the campuses of Ivy League schools across various periods of time. And in the one about Dartmouth, in the chapter about Dartmouth, it spoke a lot about how Dartmouth was not as, the book referred to it as radical as other schools like in Columbia or at Cornell, where they had like guns on the front lines and they were really going face to face. Whereas in Dartmouth, there was a different approach that was not necessarily as with those same tactics, but still just as effective, if not more. So I want to know a little bit more about how your experience being on campus and not taking no for an answer and kind of making things happen played a role in creating things like the AM, or rather the things you did to facilitate like the changes that you thought were necessary on campus. And were there problems prominent at the time that you guys felt very strongly about that you felt empowered to go after?
So we had, have you heard of the Reading Report?
Vaguely.
Judy Redding?
Yes, I have heard that, actually.
Yes. So she was like the ringleader of activism on campus. She created this report for the college about racism at the college. And she basically was the leader of like a sit-in at, on the green. And like, she basically kind of helped us along in terms of leading this charge about how the Dartmouth was racist. Now, little naive Ricky, I didn't really see the racism. I was so oblivious to because I had gone to white schools.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So I wasn't, and I grown up in this family of activism, but I sort of jumped on the bandwagon, but Judy was the leader. And it was interesting that a black woman, a 76, took that role and basically said, okay, you guys, we're doing this now. Show up on the green at 4 o'clock and we're all going to wear black and march or whatever. You know what I mean? So I was way more of a follower in that than a leader. And she was so strong and powerful. But look up the Reading Report. It's in the library.
I absolutely wrote it down. Absolutely.
Go and look, interview her. She's a badass. She's awesome. A phenomenal, phenomenal badass.
That is awesome. Okay. Thank you so much for sharing about that. Is there anything that you would have changed about your experience at Dartmouth?
I wish I could have stayed longer.
Oh.
When my kids went, my God, I had such FOMO. Oh my gosh, I had such FOMO. And when I took both of them, I stayed for 2 weeks in Hanover. when I went back to school or to school. And then they gave me restrictions. I was only allowed to visit once a term. And when Amanda was there, my dad was still alive. He died after her junior year, right before her senior year. Mm-hmm. But he was there, she'll tell you, like, all the time. And he was like, and she would call me, Mom. Because he lived in Maryland. He would take this, like, a 6 a.m. flight and mm-hmm. live to Hanover at 9. And wow. So at her dorm, knocking on the door at 9, but he would take all her friends to Lewes.
Oh, that's awesome.
But she'd be like, call me, like, Mom. And he would call her, like, from the airport, from Manchester. So she would know he was coming, Mom. Papa's coming again. Like, he's on his way here. Mom, I'm like, well, where are you? Well, I'm not in my room. Okay, well, you better go to your room fast. You know, like, back together. But my kids were like, can you please only come once a term? And I cheated quite a few times, but I had such FOMO. I wanted to do it again. I mean, I don't know that I would change anything, except for, you know what? I probably would, if I could change anything, I would probably build more relationships with white people who are now very wealthy, powerful alums, you know, like Jeff Immelt and, like, you know, head of GE. And, like, I wish that a lot of my classmates have done very well for themselves. And I know them now. I began to know them as adults, but mm-hmm. I would have spent more time doing that on campus. But again, I think I was so happy to be around Black people,
uh-huh.
you know, that that's where I put my energy.
Got it. Thank you. So now I'd like to hear about your career right now. So I know you are the CEO and co-founder of Touch the Black Breast Cancer Alliance. Can you tell me a little bit about, or actually a lot, about your organization's mission and why you decided to get involved in your capacity?
Sure. So I was diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer. And you probably don't know what that is. It's a subtype of breast cancer, but it's the highest mortality rate, the most aggressive, and it affects Black women at 3 times the rate of white women. Mm-hmm. And I had stage 3A. So I did, and I really got diagnosed. Haley was actually in China for the summer after mm-hmm. her freshman year. And so I kind of put off my mammogram because she was going to be home for a week before she had to go back to Hanover. Mm-hmm. And we were going to have a doc appointment. So I put off my mammogram and my doctor's appointment until she came home. So we're rushing around, going, doing all the stuff. And we went to the doctor together, and my doctor found a lump. Had I been doing self-exams, I probably would have found it, but I wasn't. Okay. So my doctor's, I said, well, you know, I'm taking my kid back to school. Can I wait and come back to you in a few weeks? No. We think this is serious. Go get tested. So I got a mammogram, I got sonogram, I had a biopsy, and then we got on a plane to go to Hanover. And so I packed her all up, you know, went to Walmart, got all the stuff. Actually, I don't think we did have Walmart when Haley was there. We didn't when Amanda was there. And I was leaving Hanover, going through the Boston airport to go on a 3-week business trip to California. Mm-hmm. And so my doctor called me as I was walking through security and said, Ricky, yes, you do have breast cancer. And I said, well, are you sure it was me? Are you sure the data is right? Yeah, it was you. I said, well, you know what? I have to give a speech to 300 people tomorrow, and I haven't written it yet. I'm about to get on the plane to the West Coast. Can I call you back? And I totally, like, let it go. So I got to California. I wrote my speech. I did my speech. And then I went to L.A. And then 3 days went by, and my doctor called me back and said, Ricky, not only do you have breast cancer, but you have triple negative breast cancer. I said, well, that doesn't sound so bad. Triple negative, how bad is that? And then I went to Dr. Google, and he said, you're going to die fast. We have no drugs for you. So I got on the plane and went home to Atlanta. And so then I went into this whirlwind of breast cancer. And I had a double mastectomy. I did a lot of aggressive chemo. I did radiation. And then my doctor said, okay, you're good. And then I had to go back for a checkup. And almost a year to the day of my diagnosis, they found 5 spots on my chest wall. And my doctor said, okay, you're now metastatic. You have 2 years to live. Get your affairs in order. We don't have any drugs for you. And I said, well, I can't really die right now. Haley is a sophomore at Dartmouth. I was a breadwinner for our family and the rainmaker for my company. I have to work. I have to pay for my kid to go to school. So me and God and some drugs or something, I have to work this out. And so I went back to Dr. Google, and I found the Triple Negative Breast Cancer Foundation, which I'm still on the board of, mm-hmm. and it gave me a doctor that basically put me on some experimental drugs. She was probably one of about 5 doctors at the time that were actually doing research on triple negative breast cancer.
Mm-hmm. So her name?
Her name is Ruth O'Regan.
Okay.
She's phenomenal. She was at Emory at the time. She's no longer there. She's, I think, in Michigan. But she put me on some experimental drugs, and I did a lot more chemo, and I didn't die. And it's been 11 years.
God is good.
God is good. So I know that God left me here for this, to do this work. So my first goal was to get Haley, to make it to 2014, to get Haley graduated. Mm-hmm. We're sitting there, you know, Shonda Rhimes was actually the graduation speaker. And her words of wisdom to everybody was, do the right thing. You know what the right thing is. Do the right thing. And so I think that was kind of resonating in my head. And then God just said, okay, you need to be an advocate for Black women. You made it here. I got you here. So I've been an advocate ever since. I've been on the board of the Triple Negative Breast Cancer ever since. And I started doing a lot of advocacy work while keeping my day job. So also when I had cancer, I divorced my husband of 30 years. I quit my business partners. I sold my big house in the suburbs. I started my own business between my third and fourth rounds of chemo. I made all the radio ads for the Obama campaign, the second one. And I moved to the beach, which is where I live now, on the Chesapeake Bay, where kind of where I grew up. I wouldn't recommend doing those things when you're sick, but I did. I figured out that I had to not only get the cancers out of my body, but I had to get the cancer out of all the cancers out of my life. Mm-hmm. And I totally changed my life and started a new one. And so I just have been doing advocacy as I was sort of running my own company, my marketing company. And then a few years went by and there was a study done at the University of Georgia about 2017, 2018 that identified that Black women get triple negative breast cancer at 3 times the rate of white women, but no one could explain it. Mm-hmm. I'm like, what's up with that? Why is that happening? And then I started looking around at all the data that was available, and Black women have a 41% higher mortality rate than white women of breast cancer. We have a 39% higher recurrence rate of breast cancer. Black women under 30 get breast cancer at 4 times the rate of white women. Black women under 35 get breast cancer at twice the rate and die at 3 times the rate of white women, well before they would have their first mammogram at age 40. Mm-hmm. Under 50 get breast cancer, die at twice the rate. And so I'm like, well, what's up with this? Like, why are we doing this? And then I went back and looked in history to see, okay, so the drugs that we're all taking that are standard of care, were they tested on Black bodies? And they went up.
Wow.
And so, and then I said, okay, what's happening now? And right now we only have a 3% participation in clinical research for the new drugs being developed. Mm-hmm. I think Black women have a different disease. So I went to this big breast cancer conference. This is the year before COVID. It's called the San Antonio Breast Cancer Conference. And it's like where 14,000 people come from all over the world to talk about breast cancer. It's like the biggest myth. And I tried to meet with all the pharma companies to basically say, okay, there's this thing out here. It's called Black breast cancer. And I labeled it and I called it Black breast cancer. And for the first time, nobody ever sort of thought about that. I said, Black breast cancer is a different disease. We have a different disease. It's unique. It's different. It's distinctive. And we're dying. So what are you going to do about it? Like, somebody needs to pay attention to this. And so I sort of forced these conversations with pharmaceutical companies and really kind of the breast cancer ecosystem that, hello, Black breast cancer is a thing. How are we going to fix it? Yeah. And so that's when I started my foundation, to basically address Black breast cancer as a distinct disease state. And my mission is to eradicate it. That's simple. And so, and really the best way we're going to do to eradicate it is to advance the science and get more Black women into clinical research so we can develop drugs that work on our bodies. So that's what I'm working on.
That is absolutely amazing work. And thank you for sharing your story, but also all of the important facts and knowledge to like help us all become more educated. That was amazing. Thank you. So just to kind of continue off of that, you're very involved in the community. You're very passionate about your work, but you also kind of bring these passions and involvement still to like the Black Alumni Network of Dartmouth today. So can you speak to me about your involvement with BADA and why you choose to be so heavily involved, even though you don't necessarily have to? Like, why do you do it?
Well, let me go back to one thing. So I recently started a movement called When We Trial. Go to whenwetrial.org. Yes. And we have a bunch of videos. And if you go to our YouTube channel, you'll see we have like a suite of videos, like a playlist of When We Trial to get more Black women to clinical trials. So that's a whole nother major project I'm doing. But I've been on the road since really the beginning of May, since before BATA. That was like one of my stops because I actually did a speech at BATA and at in Hanover at graduation at every unions. But I'm trying to help Black women understand the research, how it works, and that they have to advocate for themselves. So a lot of that work is in there. But anyway, so I think I was the president of BADA for, you can look at the data, probably 9 or 10 years.
Okay. Nice.
I think I was definitely the president when Amanda was there. I think I was done by the time Haley came. Mm-hmm. But I did alumni council, you know. I love Dartmouth. I would do anything for Dartmouth. And when I was the president of BADA, like, my dad was still alive, and my dad was like, well, you better go to work, girl. You know, he was one of the founders. And so I think when I first started being president, like, nobody would do the job. Mm-hmm. And we had like a reunion coming or whatever. We're trying to do reunions every 2 years. And so my dad's like, go fix this. What's wrong with you? You know, I'm too old. So, and you know, when my dad went to Dartmouth, there were 12, right? Three in each class. So they're all kind of my godfathers. We just lost my godfather, Gene Booth, like a month ago. But we still, and so Garvey's still there. Garvey Clark, mm-hmm. Are you talking to Garvey?
I have to check. One of my classmates might be, actually.
57. You got to talk to Garvey.
Okay.
I got to call him. Yes, he had COVID, I think. I got to call him. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I was always surrounded by these men that were, like, bossing me around and their kids and stuff. And, like, Wendy Clark, Garvey's daughter. But my dad basically made me have, like, guilt to do this work. but I did. You know, I was president of BADA. And I love doing that. It's a great passion to have. I've pretty much always had a Dartmouth intern working for me since mm-hmm. since I could afford to buy somebody, to pay somebody, right? Uh-huh. Most of my career. If you talk to other alums, they're like, yeah, I was your intern. And like, I was your intern. So I worked at Coke for a bit, and I always had an intern. I've always had an intern pretty much from the moment I could, like, hire people.
Yeah.
And really, I would go to Hanover and find an intern, and then the interns began to hire each other. Like, I'd go get me my next intern. Or the kids would hear, like, oh, she does internships, so go call her. So mm-hmm. it kept me connected to have a Dartmouth student working for me, which I love still. I have one now. Natan Santos, you don't know him. He graduated in 2 years ago.
Okay.
He was at 20.
Okay.
Right. He graduated in the height of COVID. God bless him. But yeah, like, he does my Instagram. So I've always had this connection, but I also wanted to influence the college and help kids. And we've had mentoring programs. We've done all kinds of stuff over the years. When I was on an alumni council, I was like the head of the chair of the student life committee.
Mm-hmm.
So just because I wanted to stay connected to kids.
Nice.
So, but BADA, we tried to do a lot of stuff with BADA, and I just tried to keep it alive. And then finally, I said, okay, somebody younger needs to do this. So we kind of put Todd Granford in the job, and then then Ellis. Was Ellis after Leah? I don't know, Ellis. But then I've always stayed involved because I had some influence in getting the next president in.
Nice.
And I'm like, okay, who's going to do this job? Right. And then when it came time to do the 50th, I mean, oh my gosh, probably 2 years ago.
It was amazing.
Or more. Were you there? Were you there? Did you see?
I had the time of my life. It was amazing.
Me too. I had to do ball. But we had so much fun. But and T Latson is one of my besties.
Yes, I know.
Forever. So my dad, you know, my dad lives in my house. So it's oftentimes in the middle of the night, I'll hear this noise. That noise when you hit the computer makes a noise. That's my dad talking. And so he woke me up one day at 4 o'clock in the morning and said, like, you're going to do this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm going to do this. So when I remember, I, you know, calling everybody saying, okay, I'm going to chair the reunion. Phew. Okay. And then I called T and I said, T, we're chairing the reunion. And she's like, okay. And so, and then for a minute, she was going to be like, I was going to be the CEO and she was going to be the president. And then after about 3 months, like, okay, we're co-chairing the reunion because I'm going to be your CEO. And thank God for her because she did so much work. But we just wanted it to be like a special time. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to get numbers. We wanted hundreds of alums to come back. And we were so happy that so many people came. So we really worked on it for 2 years. You know, we worked really hard for a year. Mm-hmm. But we were like planting seeds and calling people and trying to put the agenda together and starting committees and getting people working. We had a great program committee. And we just did it. And it was amazing. I thought so. And I think people had a good time, but I really did it for my dad. Aww. And my daughter. And my daughters couldn't even come because my niece got married that weekend. So my niece set her wedding date probably in December. Mm-hmm. Before she never called me, because I would have said, no, you cannot get married on Memorial Day weekend. Uh-huh. But so my daughters and my granddaughters were all in the wedding, so they couldn't even come. We were trying to figure out how we were going to fly up here and come back to the wedding. It was impossible. So they missed it because it was so much fun. But I did it for my dad. And I had such a blessing to have tea by my side through the whole process. And we really had an incredible committee. Everybody on our team, it was just the ultimate teamwork. Everybody, okay, here's your job. Everybody did their job with excellence. And like, we had weekly meetings on Tuesday nights. It'd be 10 o'clock on Tuesday night. We'd all be like nodding our heads, falling asleep. But you know, my hashtag is GSD, get shit done.
Yes, I love it.
And my other hashtag is DIS, do iconic shit. And so I tried to bring that into what we did. And everybody just did amazing work to make it special. So I'm so grateful to everybody that we worked with. And I don't even want to say any names right now because I'll forget somebody, but everybody that said, I'm signing up to help, they just brought it. And we all had this great, you know, Dartmouth camaraderie that you can have from Dartmouth, you know, to bring this together. And I thought it was pretty magical that we had a magical team working on it to make this magical thing happen.
That sounds so amazing. It was amazing. When I was there, I had never experienced a BATA reunion to that level of amazingness. Especially as a student, it was amazing to be there. So thank you for that.
I don't know if I want to do it again, but I know that I want to do it again anytime soon. But
I hope we do.
I'm going to miss the women. I'm really sad. I'm going to miss the women's event in November. I have like a breast cancer thing to do that week. But it was great. And alumni relations were phenomenal. They gave us all the support that we could ask for and more. So the college really stepped up and said, okay, what do you need? And when do you need it? And how can we support you? And they gave us a team of people just to get shit done. And
it was great to hear.
Yeah.
Awesome. I love that. I love your hashtags. I'm writing them down. I'm going to put them on my wall.
I know. Where are they? Over there.
Oh, that's so cool. Okay, well, is there anything special or any last comments you'd like to add?
You know, we have this family legacy that I treasure, and everybody teases me about it, but I don't really care. So our family is the third Black family with three generations.
Wow.
If you look back, we have the Wilkinson family, and Amy Wilkinson was my classmate. Mm-hmm. She was the third of her family. She didn't have any kids. Mm-hmm. And the first family was actually in the 1800s. Mm-hmm. So we're like the third. So I treasure that legacy. I treasure all the legacies that we are all creating, all my alum families. But I really want to be the fourth generation. So my granddaughters all have the t-shirts with their classes on it, 2039, 2041, 2042.
Wow.
And it's so funny because I talk to their paternal grandfather all the time. Mm-hmm. And he went to Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin. I'm like, are you kidding? Like, what? Really? You think that's even a thing? And I actually had to go. I spoke at University of Wisconsin a couple weeks ago. And so I called him. All right, I'm at your school. And it's okay. It's pretty cool here, but there's no comparison. My grandkids are not coming here. So because they have like a family legacy there. But I really, you know, and I know it's really crazy, but all I care about is for us to have this fourth generation and my kids, my granddaughters go to Dartmouth. At least one of them.
That's really so good.
But I want to create this legacy, and I encourage everybody to send your kids to Dartmouth. Like, I got to write a letter today for my friend Mark Carlson. His son is applying now. And I try to help other families get their kids in and write letters and do whatever because, you know, the white people are thriving on their Dartmouth legacies. Mm-hmm. I want families to also, you know, so you got to send your kids.
I will. I have to.
I told my kids when they got married, start saving the money now. It's going to cost you a fortune. But yes. I want to hear about it. I put both of you through school, so I'm not paying for it. I'll buy the shoes. I'll take them to Paris. I'll do all the other grandmother stuff. It's your job. It's to save for Dartmouth. So do your thing. Wow. So set up the accounts. What do you got to do? Make it happen. And so it's really special to me to have this legacy and you know, do what my dad said. And I have a great videotape of my dad that the History Makers. My dad is a history. I don't know if you're thehistorymakers.com. Mm-hmm. They basically recorded. So really a couple years before he died, I have like 3 hours of tape of him interviewing his whole life. But they asked him, why'd you go to Dartmouth? And he said, because my mother made me. And he was a basketball star. He could have gone to many schools. He was like a rock star basketball. He was an ROTC straight A student and got accepted a lot of places, but he'd kind of put Tufts in his mind. I'm not sure why, because they'd have a suck basketball team, but he was going to Tufts. And I guess he got accepted really fast or whatever to Tufts. And so he said to my grandmother, well, I'm going to go to Tufts. She's like, no, you're not. He said, well, when are we going to go? She said, well, we haven't heard from Dartmouth yet. We can talk when you hear from Dartmouth. And so when he got the letter from Dartmouth, he's like, oh, you're going to Dartmouth. He's like, okay. And my grandmother was actually the vice principal of their high school.
Wow.
You see, there were two black high schools. One was vocational and one was academic.
Mm-hmm.
My grandmother was the vice principal there. So that's where both of my parents went to high school. But my grandmother, you know, she was kind of this education force. And her her uncle was the superintendent of the black schools in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
It came from a long line of education. Yeah. And her whole family went to where did they go to school? But anyway, they all went to college for like five generations. So she really influenced my dad to go to Dartmouth, like, you're going here. And literally my uncle, who's 2 years older than my dad, came to visit my dad in like December. Like in December, he came to Hanover to bring him home for Christmas. And it was so cold. And my dad didn't have a proper coat. And so my uncle got home and sold his car to buy my dad a coat to wear back for winter. So I have great lots of stories from my mom about, you know, being in Hanover, going to Winter Carnival. So I want to continue the legacy. And I encourage everyone to build their own.
Very important and inspiring message you have there. Wow. Thank you so much, Ms. Fairley. So today is October 27th, and that wraps up our amazing interview with the amazing Ricky Fairley of Planning FBA. Okay.
Cool. So